minutes, and then he has 45 minutes. So you can talk, and he, you can still stay, and he's here to hear you talk as well. Dr. Picard is one of our CISSP instructors in undergrad, in particular CISSP. He's a cyber instructor, but kind of his love and passion is CISSP. So that's kind of what he's going to talk about tonight. And I did post that, Dr. Picard, in the channels that we have, that if they're interested in CISSP, they need to come and hear you speak, because you are the authority. He also does webinars and boot camps, basically a couple hours each quarter or so on a Sunday. If anybody wants to get together and learn CISSP stuff for a few hours, he's always available to do that. But I'll let you go ahead and kick it off, and I'll sit back and listen up. Great.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Burton. My name is Laura Bouchard. I've been teaching at Purdue for a number of years. I started, if I'm correct, in 2008, when it was still Kaplan. I've been teaching also at Boston University, on and off. Those are my fun jobs. My other jobs have been working in the private sector for various companies. I worked for a big Big Four accounting firm in Europe, worked for a whiskey company in Scotland, worked in Spain a little, Switzerland a little, worked for state government in Ohio, and worked for the U.S. Navy, U.S. Army, U.S. Air Force, and NATO. My experience at NATO was a program manager for IVNV, and I work with very senior officers, 06, 209, which was kind of interesting. I've been doing cybersecurity for over 10 years in a federal framework. And what I want to convey to pretty much everyone here is that there are plenty of jobs. I actually talked to Dr. Burton, I think it's, no, it was Jay actually. In 2009, I told him that there was a shortage of 100,000 people to do cybersecurity. And, you know, we needed to have this program started, and took a little while for us to get this going. And thanks to Dr. Burton, we have this this program right now, which prepares people for CSSP. So CSSP is the golden standard for cybersecurity. What you need to know is that there are other certs that are considered equivalent to CISSP. I'm talking about CAP, for example, CASP, and CISM. Those are considered equivalent. However, for most people that are CISSP, there are people that are CISSP, and then there's others. There's regrettably some kind of snobbism, or whatever you want to call it, where people will think, will say, you know, there's CISSPs and there's everybody else. But in terms of HR, which is what probably counts in terms of salary, know that CISSP is not an absolute requirement. The pass rate is not great. Many people that have been doing cybersecurity for a number of years have failed the exam again and again. I have a very good friend who passed CEH, which of course is no challenge, Security Plus, CISM, CISA. He's got some offensive search, such as OCSP, and it took him 7 tries to pass CSSP. So know that pretty much you shouldn't give up. You should keep trying if you want a career in cybersecurity. So let me tell you a little bit about me. Why did I go into cybersecurity? Well, I was a state government employee in the state of Ohio, and pretty much there was a massive layoff of American citizens because they could produce the same thing in India for pretty much 30 cents on the dollar, And these were people that would work 10-hour days, typically, and work really hard. I mean, the Indians that I worked with at that time were absolutely brilliant. And what I found out is that in cybersecurity, there is this shortage of people, mostly comes by the fact that less than 30% of Americans are eligible for a security clearance. So I started digging into this and looking at what was difficult to get into, and I found that it was cybersecurity. So I started in that realm because pretty much don't have competition from all of these Indian kids who are super bright, they're willing to work long hours and so forth. So I just wanted something stable where I could hopefully get, you know, an ongoing job and so forth. So this is how I got started. So what I want to tell you is that there is pretty decent money with CISSP. Unfortunately, I'm on my wrong profile right now, so I cannot share all of the links that I normally have that I share with my students. But if you have no experience at all in IT, it is very reasonable that you make $80,000, even as an associate of CISSP. So to be clear to everyone, anyone attending can sign up today, go and take the exam tomorrow, and if you pass, you will be associate of CISSP regardless of experience. Once you cross the five-year threshold, you can apply to become CISSP. Okay, so if you have no experience, you are likely to make around 80,000 or more. Depends on, you know, potentially if you get a security clearance or so forth. A security clearance such as TS could add $40,000 to your salary. So you're talking about decent salaries. It's something that you should all look into, because, you know, while I'm sure you're all here to learn and you know, you want to learn and all of this, you still probably at the end of the day want to get a career that is gonna pay your student loans and potentially, you know, help you improve your financial situation and so forth. So my message to all of you is that there are plenty of jobs. You just need to know what you want, and you potentially need to be slightly flexible. There are remote jobs. I'm actually starting to job hunt myself. I will tell you, I just noticed that a company called Textron, T-E-X-T-R-O-N, has plenty of internships in cybersecurity. Just noticed today, actually I didn't have time to notify Dr. Burton about this, but Textron, T-E-X-T-R-O-N, has plenty of internships for cybersecurity. Also, if you're interested, a company such as Northrop Grumman in Cincinnati, Ohio, is looking for interns. They're willing to sponsor for security clearances, and they're willing to hire people that have potentially no experience. Okay, so this is pretty big, because one of the most difficult things if you want to work in federal government is getting sponsored for a clearance. You cannot ask by yourself to get a clearance. You have to be sponsored by an employer and so forth. So again, you know, my message is plenty of jobs, salaries, you know, beginner 80,000. You could easily talk to talk about 100 to 250 now. If you are in the Boston area or DC area, salaries now for cybersecurity people appear to be creeping up and going and being in the range of 200,000 for people with about 5 years experience in IT. And then, you know, 400,000 is far from impossible, not in DoD, but, you know, if you are a senior person in a number of program, 400 is far from impossible. And Dr. Burton can probably attest that there was the CISO of a fairly large company that revealed that he was making 400,000 when we did our conferences 2 years ago, I think it was. So that's what the message that I wanted to convey. Do you have any questions for me? Let's make this interactive and talk about cybersecurity, CISSP, and all of those things. Do you have questions for me?
I'll ask one on behalf of some of the students that I see here that may be earlier in the program. What's the likelihood that they can take the classes? Because we have three classes that map to CISSP for anybody that doesn't know that already. And it's 30 weeks. And Dr. Bacard teaches some of those. So what's the likelihood if someone took all of those classes, but they really don't have a background in cyber yet, that they could pass the exam?
It's a great question. Thank you very much. My recommendation would be that a person start first by doing, there is a class that maps Security Plus. Just do this at the same time as CISSP 1, so IT 277. To get a good idea about the field. Then potentially ask Dr. Burton for permission to take IT 279 and IT 410 at the same time. What I will say is that to pass, it appears in most cases to be a function of absolute commitment into doing what is required. Typically, you need 200 to 400 hours of studying in roughly 8 to 12 weeks. If you study more than 12 weeks at an intense pace, you probably are gonna give up because it's gonna be too much. If you don't study 8 weeks, you probably will not have the kind of knowledge that you need. Let's be honest, you are looking for most people at 20 hours a week of studying. I know it's a lot. I personally did it. So the way I did it was I told my better half that I wanted to take the exam. I explained to her what was CISSP. I explained to her how much I should make after I took the exam. I talked to her about the careers. I mean, I had... that was back in 2008 when I prepared for this. I had to actually give a PowerPoint presentation explaining, you know, what was CISSP, what I planned to do with it, the job prospects, the salaries, and so forth. And then I asked her, and, you know, it's relative. Some of you may think it's a little extreme, but I asked her pretty much that... we would only meet on Friday nights and Wednesday nights and Sunday afternoons and evenings, so that the rest of the time I had no distraction. And she accepted my request. I got her involved with this. We kind of played games where she would quiz me on some questions, which of course was kind of a little funny because she would ask me what's the CIA, for example, and I would answer confidentiality, integrity, availability, and I would reverse one word, and she would say, "Well, it's not how it's said." So it was kind of funny, but you know, it gave her an opportunity to get engaged with my project. I think it was very important to get a buy-in. Because, you know, she was every day, okay, how was the study? How many questions did you take on CCure? How many questions did you review? How many pages of each book did you read? So I would recommend that you use a tool such as CCCure. If you have access to the book that we had access to, the book on page 1000 has free access to 2000 questions on Cybex. That's 2000 free questions. I would strongly suggest that you do all of those free questions, all of them. And then I would suggest that you review in great details what each answer was. Even if you were right and wrong, you need to review why it's right, why it's wrong, to make sure you absolutely understand why a question is right and why a question is wrong. You know, I was listening to podcasts. I also printed, there is two documents. You can search for Sunflower PDF, CISSP. There is a great document that everybody tells me is pretty good. And then there is another document which is from Eric Allaire, which is A-L-L-A-I-R-E. And if you search for these CISSP PDF, I printed 10 copies of this document. I had a copy in my car, a copy in each room of the house. And whenever I had a moment free, pretty much, I would go and look at the book, the 10-page book, to make sure that I knew all of the important concepts. What you need to be aware of is that the exam is a mile wide and an inch thick. What it means is that you need to know pretty much everything. The US Navy has mapped CISSP as equivalent in most cases to a master's in cybersecurity. So really, you have to step up considerably your knowledge in IT in general to pick up the slack, if I may say so, and learn. There is a lot of reading, a lot of memorization. Keep in mind that you don't need to be an expert in all of the 8 domains. You just need to be willing to you need to have experience in 2 of the domains. Okay, so if you have this experience, you are eligible to become CISSP. But again, you don't need experience to take the exam. Anyone could go and take the exam tomorrow if they want to.
There was a question in the chat, kind of related to what you're saying earlier. David asked, so what's like the most financially lucrative career path in cyber? They really are about the salary.
Well, you know, it's very, very relative. I'm going to urge all of you to look at a company called Dragos. Dragos does ICS, Industrial Control System. And Robert Lee was actually a guest of Dr. Burton and I a few months ago. And he created his own company. It's worth over $1 billion now. And they do a lot of cyber stuff dealing with industrial control systems. In my class I showed last Sunday, many of the jobs are over 200 plus benefits. Typically they value benefits around 60 to 150,000. So, you know, again, it depends. This Dragos, no security clearance. You just have to be willing to learn probably Linux. I'm going to say with Dragos, you need to have a very good understanding of Linux. CISSP is not going to be as important for them. It's just going to show that you know the basics. CISSP, again, is a theoretical exam that is managerial in nature. To summarize CISSP, you could just say that it's an exam that a 20-year-old smart kid from Europe would take with no work experience and no knowledge of Department of Defense or anything American. And then this person has a good chance to pass. Salaries, Donald asked. I know that in Switzerland, salaries are pretty decent. Outside of Switzerland, I don't know. I just read that the average salary for CISM is 150,000 now. CISM is equivalent to CSSP, according to the DoD. So, you know, we can assume it's fairly equivalent. So 150,000 worldwide, the average salary. Career ladder. That's a difficult question. I don't know how to answer David Perez's question. The ideal person in cybersecurity would be able to write policies, conduct scans, and remediate findings. This would be the ideal person in cybersecurity, in my opinion. This is at a non-managerial level. At a managerial level, it's more project management oriented, with probably a CISSP to show that, you know, you have the basic knowledge in cybersecurity. There's actually a very interesting statistic that the average number of certification held by a CISSP charter holder is 4. This is the certification. There was a study, I don't remember who did this, but there was a study of if you know, each certification, what other certifications do you hold? And CISSP was the certification where people had the most other certifications. So I think it's indicative of something. Thank you, Dr. Burton. IT-286, yes, it's for Security Plus. I think getting Security Plus first is probably a good move. If you've not taken any certifications recently, I'm going to make a very silly suggestion, which would be to take a test such as GRE, GMAT, even a test of English as a foreign language. Any test that forces you to process questions quickly would probably be useful if you're not used to it. It's why I urge people to take a lot of questions on CCQR and Cybex to make sure that you are ready to take questions quickly and not be stressed out.
Yeah, basically what he's describing is what we've been talking about for years when it comes to CISSP is it's about the stamina. It's about building your stamina. And that's one of the things that you'll see in the 273 or the 277 and 79 and 410 classes is there's a lot of practice tests and exams for that reason. And to Dr. Picard's point, the more questions you look at, it's not that you're going to see the exact same questions when you get to the exam. It's that, in, you know, it's kind of that ability to keep taking one after another and cranking out the answers without fatiguing and lacking the energy to go on. So, and the test is responsive today, right? Dr. Picard, what have you been hearing from industry people about their times now in the test? Because it used to be 3 or 4 hours, whether you passed or not, and now it's responsive. So,
yeah. The test is adaptive. I think it's what they say. So potentially the exam is over at 125 questions. We had a number of students from Purdue who pretty much answered every question right. But these were students, again, who were exceptionally motivated. They accepted to sacrifice 8 to 12 weeks of their time to concentrate virtually the entire life on studying. Again, you don't need to memorize everything for the rest of your life. Cryptography, for example, I learned it for the exam. I review it each time I teach that topic, but frankly, it's not something I use on a daily basis. So those are things that, you know, you're probably gonna not remember the day afterwards, and that's okay. Well, this is a memorization exam.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you're gonna go take the bar, right? I mean, law students probably cram for months before they go take the bar, but that doesn't mean they're gonna remember all of that the day after. And because they'll have their law books to go back to and look things up if you need to. I guess they still do that. I don't know. They still look at law books. But the point being is that there's a lot of industry examples where you kind of have to cram and know a lot of stuff for a very short period of time to pass the test. But then, you know, you have resources available to you. And clearly most of what you learn is going to change at some point. Yeah, 125 is what he said. And it just used to be that what the way that it would work is they had the same number of questions and you would sit there until you finished them all, whether you passed or not, you wouldn't know it. My understanding now is as you are good at it, if you're taking the test and you're doing well, then they just kind of skip to the next section or the next domain. And therefore you would end up with less questions and it would take less time. I think some of them have reported, you know, finishing in an hour and a half or so instead of the 3 or 4 hours that they used to have to endure before. So definitely a better style exam.
So a bot named Lou asked a question. So I'm gonna go and try to share my screen. Give me 1 second to type. Okay, let me share my screen. Screen. Screen one. Now. Okay, and we're gonna do. No, sorry, school. So the US Navy has, I think it's, if I can find it. Okay, it's this one. Okay, so they have created this framework. Where pretty much all of the careers are defined, and all you need to do pretty much is click on a role such as information system security manager, and then it tells you at intermediate level you need a bachelor, at advanced level you need a graduate degree or some of those classes or those classes, those certifications here. So as you can see, CSSP is pretty much always considered equivalent to a graduate degree. It's not always the case. There is one or two things. I think it may be this one, where it's not sufficient. No, it's not this one. It's the... I can't find it right now. Enterprise architect, I think, requires a higher certification. Yes. So this is the only, I think, certification. It's one of the only two career paths where you need something higher than CSSP. And there is 3 concentrations higher. It's ISSAP, ISSEP, and ISS MP. But pretty much, you know, if you go here, all of those jobs are mapped. It will tell you what certification or type of degree you can get to pretty much map to those jobs. There is shortage pretty much everywhere. You know, I can tell you sadly that if you are a developer, you could potentially make more than some of those jobs, whether it's right or wrong. But a developer in Python, Java may get a little more than someone that has a CSSP that can analyze software code and so forth. So this is some of the bugs of the system where potentially developers make more. there are jobs everywhere, pretty much. So questions, I think now it's 125 to 150, I think, something like that. Again, it's adaptive. Excuse me. You're going to have more or less questions based on how well you do. Potentially, you'll only have 125 questions if you answer everything correctly. And you may go maybe up to 200 questions. Any other questions?
There is another question from a bot named Lou. Is it hybrid of multiple choice and performance?
The questions are always multiple choice. I mean, there may be only two choices for some questions, but typically it's 2 to 4 questions. There may be some questions where there's more, but typically it's 4 questions per question, 4 answers for each question. There may be some questions where you need to link A, B, C, D with 1, 2, 3, 4. You don't know, Steve. It's supposed to be 70%, but they have a secret sauce that they don't talk about to see, to determine if you pass or not. The way I recall it worked, I actually wrote questions for CSSP. I actually attended various what is called CSSP pool events. So ISC Square flew me to Miami and I met with people from all over the world and we reviewed questions and so forth. The way it works typically is they look for each question, how well people do. So you are scored pretty much on each question based on how well you do. So it's a weird system for determining if you pass or fail. I don't recall a person named Curtis, but...
one of my staff members actually used to write the questions. He's also in the same career path, so I didn't know if he had crossed paths with him.
Well, I had to drop out of writing questions because there was a conflict of interest since I started teaching around that time CISSP at Purdue. So I had to, mention to ISC Square that there was a conflict of interest and I cannot write questions or review questions for 2 years, I think, after I finished teaching CSSP for any organization. Does it answer the question, Steve, in terms of passing score?
Oh, it does. It does. Makes sense. There must be weighted values on each question, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, they'll look at, each question again, what is the pass rate? And if there is something really wrong where, everybody gets it wrong, it may not have much weight. But if a question has a 90% pass rate and you answer wrong, this is not going to be good for you. Again, all of this stuff, ISC Square typically doesn't talk too much about because it's kind of, their secret sauce. But again, my message to you is if you fail the exam, which can happen, many people fail the first time, cry for a week, try again a month later. If you fail again, take a few months off, study again. And consider taking CISM, CASP, CAP, or another certification. it could be a very good idea for many individuals.
Yes, Professor Ricard, I have a question. Is it a virtual questionnaire that is done virtually, or is it in person?
I mean, you know, I took my exam a long time ago when it was still paper and pen, and I had to wait 12 weeks. Now, from what I understand, you go to Prometrics, you get your questions asked immediately, and then you get immediately if you pass or fail, nearly immediately. What I would recommend, and this is important, in my opinion, prepare a backpack, purse, whatever you want to call that, and plan for the worst. So I would suggest that you bring earplugs, potentially headache medicine. I mean, whatever you need to survive a 3 or 4 hour ordeal in case it lasts longer than scheduled. I would bring, you know, water. You probably will not be allowed to bring water in the room, but typically you will be allowed to have water outside of the room. So what I would say is talk to the testing center before. I'm going to even say drive there to know how you're going to go there, where you're going to park, and so forth, because you don't want to be stressed the day of the exam. So I personally drove 100 miles each way to the testing center to know where it was. I asked questions, can I bring water? Can I bring a sandwich? This was when I did other certs. And, you know, they'll tell you what you're allowed to do, not do. Be careful, for example, you may not be allowed to wear a digital watch. You may have to wear an analog watch. Also, I would say, you know, plan your exam carefully. I force myself every 40 minutes or so to take a 5-minute break, have some water or, you know, go to restroom, whatever you need to do to pace yourself and make sure you don't go crazy. When I took the exam, you know, it was 6 hours at that time, and many people afterwards didn't remember where they parked their cars or things like that, because it was really, really intense. So my suggestion is plan for your exam, know where you're gonna go, have all of the tools to mitigate any issue you may have, so that you so that you're successful. Any other question? Thank you, Arianna, for the question.
Thank you, Professor Picard. Those are meaningful words, and if there's any day to be prepared, it's that day. So it sounds like this is in person, and be prepared to be able to sustain the full time there. So is there a time limit on it that they give?
I think it's 3 or 4 hours now. Let me search for it. The exam is about $700. I would have to get back to you. I don't remember the duration of the exam now. Okay, so there's 50 pretest questions, and 125 to 175 questions, and a maximum of 3 to 4 hours. Hi, Nelly. How are you doing?
Welcome, Nelly, Professor Nelly. So we've Is that the standard fee that would be paid at the time, or is it every single time that you test?
Yeah, I think it's $700 each time you test. So it's expensive to fail, but this is the way it is. CISM, I think, is about the same fee. The only one that is cheap is Security Plus, but Security Plus will not get you as much money in terms of salary. I mean, you know, I know people that just have a Security Plus and a TS, and they make over $100,000, but that's because they have a TS. Otherwise, you probably, with a Security Plus in a DoD environment, you're probably going to make less. No worries, Nelly. Nelly, you took CSSP, right?
No, I'm familiar with the content of your classes. They are really amazing. I'll say, like, some of the most comprehensive classes I've seen out there that we have.
Oh, I try. Thank you for having attended those classes. Yeah. Any other questions, David? Are you planning to take the exam? Okay. Well, my advice is don't wait too long. The exam changes, and all of the investment that you make attending the class, the longer you wait, the more you're going to have to redo everything. You know, it's going to require more studying. There's 8 domains right now to study, but they are the size of the domains varies significantly. Domain 3 is a lot bigger than some of the other domains. Security engineering does include crypto, some physical security, and so forth. And it's potentially a lot bigger than some of the other domains. I understand, David. I mean, stuff happens. A key, again, to pass is absolute commitment. For me, the key was asking my better half to agree to let me do it, and she accepted it. But the only problem is she takes half ownership of my CSSP. That was, you know, I think it's important to have a support system to make sure that, you know, you're committed and you just get it done. Anyone else planning to take the exam? Do you know when you're going to take the exam, Jennifer? Okay, so I suggest that you have your 10-week, William, I suggest you have a 10-week schedule going back. The bad thing is that you really cannot make a big break for Christmas. Maybe you can do 1-day break for Christmas. Otherwise, it's gonna conflict, if you don't mind my opinion, okay? Of course, William, you do as you deem best. Again, a bot named Lou, you can take the exam with no experience. The youngest CSSP was under 18, was, I don't remember now, I have a doubt. I think it was a 14 or 16-year-old kid from India. The kids studied very hard, passed the exam, and then they changed the way things are done so that people have experience. But again, anyone can potentially go and take the exam tomorrow. Okay, William, again, my personal advice, and I hope you don't mind me saying that, would be for you to...
Thank you for speaking, Dr. Bouchard. We'll go ahead and let Steve talk now.
Okay. And... Thank you, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Steve?
Oh, thank you, Dr. Bouchard. Hello, my name is Steve Gerlesky, and I am a federal IT program manager. And I had met Nellie, and she had talked to Bob Cunningham and myself to talk us into coming in to talk to you guys tonight. I actually do have some slides, if you don't mind. I will present them. That way it keeps me on track. So let me go ahead and open those up, and I'll see if I can use your... Hopefully I can figure out your system here. Should be fairly intuitive. So I'm gonna share just the slides that I have. And then I'm actually okay if you want to stop me anywhere along the line, but I thought I would talk about my background, my experiences in my career, in my career path, and then really the lessons learned. You know, as you're going through your education, I had learned some very valuable, I guess, lessons that maybe if someone would have told me early on, I could have avoided some, some misery and not had to learn these things on my own. And so maybe I thought I'd just kind of tell you the things I learned along my way and on my IT journey. But my background is I have two undergraduates, one in healthcare management, one in business management. I've taken a plethora of classes in Dante's CLEP, traditional brick and mortar schools, as well as distance learning. Kind of like you. I also have a MBA, which is really 44 doctoral hours. So that allows me to teach at the undergraduate and graduate level in IT. I also have a MPA in emergency management. And at one time I was a certified emergency manager. So I wasn't really sure my own career path when I was coming through my education. But my background is I have 22 years in the Air Force. I spent most of that, all of it in medical, but medical readiness, putting patients on airplanes and helicopters, as well as medical IT. It was a very diverse career field. And so I have done about equal in both in IT and medical readiness. After the military, I was doing some consulting in Washington, D.C., where I worked on an enterprise-wide resource planning tool. If anybody's familiar with that, it's an Oracle-based system. I also did career development for the Officer Corps and some organizational development. If anybody's ever been a consultant, there's good money, but you're only as good as your last contract. So I thought I'd start looking for a federal job. And I did take a role as a hospital CIO for the federal government in the Midwest. I also worked some emergency communications for the VA. And also, I recently got promoted in January, and I'm the chief people person, so I'm part of the executive staff, and you met my boss a couple weeks back, Bob Cunningham. I do teach for two different universities on the side, teaching undergraduate and graduate IT, as well as I teach undergraduate emergency management. And so I try to stay active. One of the things that's nice about teaching is that I stay current through students, if that makes sense. And I really do enjoy teaching. But I thought I'd tell you a little bit about my career path because it really wasn't strategic at all. I really looked for opportunities, and that was both in emergency management and in IT. So I moved when I was no longer growing, I wasn't learning, or the job wasn't fun anymore, essentially. So I took on challenges and I built upon strengths. I mean, just as a side note, I also volunteered for a lot of projects. Some of the projects were really defining moments for me in my career. One of the projects where I was still in the military, I was finishing up my first undergraduate and I had to do an internship. So I asked if I could do an internship where I worked and they said, well, sure, the college did. And so I took on a wiring project, a Cat5e premise wiring project for the school that I worked at. Is a military school, and it was 13 different buildings, multi-million dollar project. And so from that, it really opened up a lot of doors. It allowed me to put, you know, that I was a project manager on my resume for a very large project, very large successful project, I might add. And so I would, I guess I would encourage anyone to try to take on big projects because they're always growth experiences. But you know, as you're working your career, you have to balance, you know, growing and in performing, you know, and doing well in your career. So if I'm talking too fast, I can slow down if you want. I'm certainly a fast speaker by nature. But I thought I'd share some of the lessons learned in my career path. And the first one, you know, if you you know, Dr. Richard really did talk a lot about money. I actually don't make that much. I'm a federal employee. GS-14, you could look that up. It's certainly nowhere what the security folks make. But I do like my job and I do have a comfortable salary. But when you're going out there to look for, and I'll supplement what Dr. Burchard was talking about. When you go out there and you start looking for your next career, you graduate from school, you get your certifications, you're ready to take on the world. You have to know your value. And I think that he really presented that well, is that's the value, that's the market. And when you're going to your first interview, I will tell you that the only time to negotiate salary is when you're negotiating your first job or whatever job you're in, because there's no other time that you can negotiate salary. After you're given the offer, you're not going to be able to negotiate salary. I'll just tell you lessons learned that when I left the military, I was offered my first job post-military, and they look at your salary history, and you know, obviously, I wasn't making that much because I was in the military. And so they did give me a lowball offer and they said, well, we'll catch up with you, you know, in a year or so. And so I was getting paid substantially less than my counterparts because I accepted the low offer. I eventually did leave that company and really, you know, essentially for a $60,000 raise with another company because, you know, I understood my value and I understood the power of negotiations on the front end. And so whenever you're going out there and you're looking for your next job, you have to know the salary range of the job that you're looking for. It's really important because you can't negotiate unless you really know what the range is for that specific position. And so just to tell you a few stories, but I had failed at both. One of the jobs I was competing for was for a state agency in Florida. And it was a very high, I guess, very high position. And that I couldn't get myself to say that I'd work for $100,000 essentially. And so I said so I'd work at my current salary. And I didn't get that job because they said, since I didn't actually say that I needed six figures, they took that as I didn't have the self-worth to ask for it. And so with the lessons learned, I took that to the next job interview, and it was for a emergency management position, managing six hospitals. And so I said, well, I boasted, well, I'll start out at six figures, and they were only looking to pay 80. And so they're like, no, there's no way we'd pay you that much. And so I guess that's why I would encourage you to really do a lot of research before you start, you know, looking at the job market, because it can be brutal with hiring managers. And then, you know, always, you know, get your firm offer in writing. All employers, including the federal government, always looks at salary history. You have to be able to answer that question on why you are so worth so much more than your last job. So if it's a certification, if it's new experience, if it's your finished your college education, but I can guarantee you, to bridge a gap from your last salary to your what you want, you're going to have to be able to talk about that, because every employer I've ever seen will always go back to your last salary history. So keep that in mind as you're negotiating your salary. Really love the whole certification discussion earlier. Kind of, I was thinking about certifications as you're leaving school. Is you have to understand what the requirements for every position you're looking for, and that could be education, skill sets, and certifications. You really want to do a lot of research as you're targeting a specific career. Like I said, I didn't necessarily target a career. I actually was more of a opportunist when I was working my career, but there's a lot of certifications out there. Just CISSP is really, I actually agree. IDLE, AWS is another certification. You know, I'll just tell you, the federal agency I work in is hosting a lot of things in the cloud, and that, you know, the AWS certifications are kind of cool. There's a market for that now as well. Ethical Hacker, PMP, that's a great certification to have if you want to be a project manager. It does take a lot of hours. You have to prove that you've done, I don't know, you have to quote me on this, but I think it's like 2,000 hours of actual project management time, but you can count anything. You can bean count anything, all of your projects for your whole career. But these really do well into, you know, getting your next position. So really select a certification that aligns with your interest in your career goals. I did want to talk a little bit about resumes, because a lot of misconceptions about resumes. I've read a lot of resumes in my career. I've been a selecting manager, both from the military, selecting civilian employees. My current role, I've looked at a lot of resumes. And then when I was a consultant or a contractor, if you will, I looked at a lot of resumes. They're all very different. The federal resumes are very different than the private sector resumes. You know, you could look at them chronologically, functionally, the length. You know, they always say in the private sector, you know, you should have 2 pages. And then for me as a federal employee, my resume is about 14 pages long. So that seems fairly long. But when you go for federal jobs, they really do scavenge your resume. They do word counts. They have, they look for how many times, if you're going to be a supervisor, that says supervisor in your resume. So I literally put my entire working history, which is a long time. So, you know, think about, you know, what your, you know, what kind of job you're looking for, and you may, you know, write a federal resume much different than a private sector resume. You know, for if I was just graduating college and I had a specific skill set and I wanted to work in security, kind of what Dr. Richard was saying, I might write a functional resume and just show what skill sets I have currently and what my certification allows me to do. So it really, but if you ask 1,000 different people, you get 1,000 different answers on this. I'll just tell you a lesson learned from me personally is a lot of people will tell you to write your resume towards specific jobs. I really stopped doing that. I actually wrote my resume when I got my federal job is who I thought I was. And I took a long time to do that. And when I was able to capture who I was, it was really evident on what the job offers I was getting. It really changed the trajectory. So I just kind of captured who I think I am and what I think, you know, was important to me. And then I had a lot of job offers, usually multiple job offers, because I thought it was more genuine than trying to write to a specific job ad. So just a quick snippet of my resume is one of the big things that I did differently on this current resume is I wrote outcomes, because a lot of resumes I see, they'll write their job description, what they're chartered to do from their supervisor, and it never shows outcome. If you don't show outcome, the important thing on a resume is to show that you did something really important. Numbers, you know, metrics really matter. You know, how far did you move the needle? How much did you, you know, make? How much did you sell? How big was the project? How many servers are you hosting? You know, whatever it is, you have to measure it and you have to show that you're successful. And that's important, because when you look at a lot of resumes, both in the public and private sector, you have to look for things that capture the reader. You know, you would think that, you know, like a hiring official will read every word of a resume, but, you know, they're oftentimes with an opening, you might get 70, 80 resumes of all qualified candidates. And so you have to go look through them pretty fast to find who you really want to work with and who might have what you need. And I always look for who is successful. And I look through that through the outcomes. If they show an outcome on their resume and they show somewhere in a summary that they can do what I want them to do, then I want to talk to them. And so, you know, think about that as you're writing your resumes, because, you know, it's super important to do that. So, like I said, I wrote one resume and I stopped updating towards jobs. I keep one current resume updated. Mine's very long. Federal resumes are much longer. And I put the key skills up front. I put the skills that I can do at the very top so they know. And then, like I said, I put it chronological with outcomes. I just heard a beep. Is everybody still there? Can you guys hear me?
Yes, this is Nelly Molyneux. I do have a question for you. What kind of skills do you think we can put on a resume that would, are we talking about like soft skills or technical skills, or what are the skills that we should put on a federal resume?
Well, I put skills like in my resume, I put that I'm an accomplished project manager, that I'm an accomplished manager supervisor, that, you know, I have leadership skills. I put skills that were on positions I would be targeting. I guess if that helps. I mean, I've done, you know, a lot of technical work. You know, I worked with databases, so I'd put, you know, that I'm familiar with Oracle databases, for example, that I've done tier 3 support for Oracle databases. So I put that at the top of the resume, because one of the things you'll find with hiring managers is they do want to look through your resume really fast. If your resume, and there is some, I guess, your resume should be neat and tight and readable, that it would be attractive to somebody wanting to read more. But if you put it really clear and concise, I have a box at the top of mine that just says, here's who I am. And I put all of the executive courses I've taken too, because, you know, I'm really targeting supervision management leadership roles. And so I target all those roles up front, because that's what I'm looking for. I do have technical skills, but they're, you know, getting buried as I continue to lead and manage and you know, manage programs and people. Does that help?
Yes. Will you say that for someone who is more like an entry level, who might not have as much experience, regardless of the field, whether they're trying to do something technical or something more like project management oriented, will you say, are there any soft skills that are worth to mention? Like, and I'm thinking like perhaps like attention to detail or some soft skills that are very important to highlight.
Yeah, I actually, well, it's kind of funny you say that because, you know, I helped my son write his resume and, you know, he was just, you know, getting out of school, and I would put that he was adaptive and quick learner. I put that, you know, he was, I actually put that, you know, since we've lived in multiple countries, that he was adapted to change and diversity. I put that on his resume because I thought that was important, that they would know that about him, and that he was a quick learner. So yeah, those are soft skills that you can put on a resume. And you are right. Is if you're just coming out of school, that you probably, you know, wouldn't have the same skill sets. You're still learning. So yeah, I think the soft skills are fine. And then if you graduate, for example, if you graduate from, and you want to put that on there, I know a lot of people put their GPA. You can put, if you are like magna cum laude or something, you know, that's a cool bullet, right? If you're just out of school and, you know, people would understand that, you know, you really are a scholar, right? They would gravitate towards that. But, you know, after a couple of years and you've graduated, they really want to know more about what you're doing in the field. And I might like, well, I was magna cum laude, but I don't think I put that on my resume anymore because, you know, I'm almost 60. No one cares. You know what I mean? So what you would put on a resume for someone younger, yeah, you're right. The soft skills would work.
So if we spin this around a little bit, you review a resume. Are there things that you look for that you will say, hey, I really like to see this person because I can see how this person has, I don't know, initiative or perhaps knows how to write per se, or
is, oh, yeah,
anything
actually,
that you like to see on resumes?
Absolutely. So I look for, the skill should be in a summary box that you're hiring for. So if you're hiring for, I mean, let's just say system administrator, for lack of a better analogy. First, I look to see, can they do that? That should be in the summary, right? So system administrator. And then I do actually look for attention to detail in the resume. You know, if they have misspellings and it's hard to read and it's all scrunched together and it hurts my eyes, it's not as palatable as you know, someone who's taken the time to build it and to tell a story. I look for the story, you know, that, okay, so I'm looking for a system administrator. They're a system administrator at this hospital and they manage, you know, they had a staff of 2,000 and, you know, they were the lead system admin and they brought on new systems and onboarded all of the users, and whatever the metrics are. I look for the results. So tell me not only that you can do the job, but tell me how you've done the job in the past, because that's important. That's why I say it's important to have a result. It's honestly not enough to say that you have the skill set. I really want to know, well, in the context of that skill set, how do you perform? And that's the story that you tell in your resume. Does that help at all?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
So in my career, I've lived a lot of places. So keep in mind, I was also in the military, but, you know, I've always went where the work is. And, you know, that's I know that's a hard call for people that are, you know, that are graduating. They're like, oh, I want to stay in my hometown, but I want this job and the work's not here. You know, sometimes you can work remote. I do in my current job, which is kind of cool. Sometimes you have to go where the work is. I know when I retired from the Air Force, we were living in North Texas and nice neighborhood, good school system, and we decided to go to Washington, D.C. because it was good for my career. You know, I had opportunity in IT that I wouldn't have had in North Texas. So the skills were in demand. They still are in demand in Washington, D.C. So, you know, we went out there, and, you know, my wife became a teacher in the school system out there. And I was working, you know, as a consultant for the Air Force. And so it was a good move at the time. And so I was willing to advance my career. I was willing to move. So it's a hard call for people when you're making that decision, that career decision. But for me, it worked out. For me, it was worth it. But, you know, having been military, I was also used to it. So it wasn't foreign to move. Here's one that's near and dear to my heart is, are we there yet? You know, as you, especially if you're graduating, you get your CISSP, you know, I would say never arrive. You know, IT is such a dynamic field that, I mean, this is one of the fields that you'll never stop learning. You really can't stop learning. I'm a lifelong learner. I believe in, you know, continuous education, continued development. I still take specialized classes. I still take courses in leadership because I want to keep learning. Everything changes, not only IT, but philosophies, leadership philosophies change. And so since it is so dynamic, I would just encourage you to continue on with, you know, CEUs, if you will, as well as an advanced degree. I didn't leave the military until I finished my first master's because I knew that it was a brutal world out there, and I really did want to, you know, make a little bit more money. And so I stayed on to finish my my master's. But if you think about, you know, since I started in IT, you know, the big thing was, you know, I had my own server room, several in different locations, but we went from that to we outsource all of the support. It's all on AWS. We no longer even have data centers hardly. We went from developing software to COTS. I started out in DOS, if anybody even knows what that is. So I'm just going to embarrass myself by that. But, you know, went from DOS to Windows. NIST, ISO, and all of the governing directives seem to change. I'm a little bit more in tune to NIST because I was the CP lead for the VA for many years as the functional expert on contingency planning. But, you know, you're going to have to look for new technologies, be in front of the trends, and you're going to have to really make sure that your CEUs and your education align with, you know, your current trajectory of your career. And so I just encourage you to never stop learning though, because, you know, by the way, that little computer is a 286. If anybody knows what that was actually what I started out with. It was computers like that and mini computers, and which nobody probably has heard of. The other thing I want everybody to kind of keep in mind is, you know, to network and get with people. You know, you really need a strong network. If you're going to make the money that you want to make, you have to make a network of the alumni, the people in the rooms with you, your professors. Use LinkedIn, connect with everybody. Professional organizations. I can't say enough about professional organizations. I'm a big proponent of professional organizations. I know that Dr. Bouchard talked about ISC Squared. That's, you know, one organization. But there's just a lot of them out there, and they're connected with people that are, you know, the movers and shakers of the industry, and that can help you get to the next level. And they know the pathway. Get a mentor, somebody who's, you know, really has what you want and can help you get there. You know, just the other day, I had one of my students in Maryland, you know, who I had been working with for several years, who asked me to, you know, be his, to get him in as a chance to the teaching system out there. And so I was, you know, I was one of his, I guess, mentors to get him into teaching. But I did help him out with grad school. We did work together on finding him the right grad school. But, you know, you'd be surprised if you ask someone to be your mentor, you know, they will definitely show you the ropes. In my personal life, when I was still in the Air Force, I actually had a lot of officer mentors that helped me. And when I left the military, they helped me get to Washington, D.C. and helped me on my first couple jobs. And so I guess I just encourage you to find a mentor. Because, you know, nobody that arrives at a certain location minds giving other people directions on how they got here, just so you know. And here's my big take on work. And, you know, Nellie's worked with me some, but you know, work should be fun. And I still enjoy work. I like fun environments. You know, if it's not fun, it's a grind, and everybody will know you're not happy, and it's just hard to perform, right? And so, me personally, if it gets to the point it's not fun, I start looking. I just look for another job. And so, you know, right now it's really a lot of fun. I feel like the job I'm doing is fun and important, and we're doing good things. So, yeah, I'll probably do this until it's not fun anymore. But one of the things that I think is important, and even when I got this job, is, you know, some things that you want people to have very defined skill sets. But you're also, when you hire somebody, you're hiring an attitude. You're hiring, do I want to work with this person long term, especially in the federal government? When you hire somebody, you're hiring them for like 30 years. So you're real careful when you hire somebody. So you hire people with really good attitudes that want to work on a team. You know, it's really an attitude fitness test. And sometimes the attitude takes precedence over competency, because you can teach people how to work, but you can't teach somebody to have a good attitude and work with others, right? And so that's really important that, you know, when you go to interviews and you're on the work site, that, you know, just let your work ethic and attitude prevail. You know, be the person that people want to work with, because that has gotten me more jobs than anything, to be honest, because, you know, I'll work with anyone because it's important. Because it's just work, right? I don't make any work personal. So I don't know if that's helpful to anybody, but that's really just my story. And I certainly would answer any questions.
This is really good. And actually, it helps a lot to see how sometimes we want to expand a lot on what we have done in the past, even if it's not very relevant to the position we're applying for. And sometimes that kind of like disqualifies, especially for the private sector, right? It disqualifies a lot of people that share previous experience only because the experience doesn't match what the requisition might be asking for. And sometimes they just want to see a lot of information on a single smaller thing, or not necessarily smaller, but a single thing, and kind of like ignoring a little bit of the extra that we have done, right? So this actually helps out a lot to see the difference between the private sector type of resume and the federal resume, right? Like we might be want to be more straight to the point. Hey, if you're looking the way you were using system administrator, we want to see the system admin type of candidate. Then perhaps just even if you've done it once, you want to have, 20 items there. And perhaps if you did customer service, if they don't care for that too much, then you probably don't want to elaborate that too much in the private sector. But the public sector, we want to do the complete opposite. We want to elaborate as much as we can on absolutely everything we have done. Is that what I'm getting from what you were saying regarding federal?
Absolutely. Resumes? Yeah, the federal resumes are just long because you don't have hiring managers sifting through resumes. you have HR staff, usually lower ranking HR staff, and they'll use some automated systems and they'll look for things. They'll do word searches essentially. And so your resume will never get certified. It'll never see a hiring manager if you don't have enough words, enough dialogue in it. You know, just an example, when I left Central Iowa, I was a CIO at Central Iowa. I wanted to hire my replacement, and he was from Washington, D.C., and he was a former hospital director. And so he had in his resume, he was a former hospital director and a CIO. He also worked in Washington, D.C. with me at the Air Staff. And HR said he wasn't qualified because although he was a hospital director, it didn't say he was a supervisor, because that's kind of what you get sometimes with the federal sector, is they're very concrete. And they couldn't see, like, well, if you're the director, you supervise everyone. And so he literally had to rewrite his resume and put supervisor enough times where they would say, oh, he's been a supervisor. And so that's why in the federal sector, you have to go a little bit longer. In the private sector, you know, time is money. They really want a person for a very specific job, and they want to look quickly, because that's the way I was in the private sector. Can they do the job? If that helps. One thing about, and we didn't really hit on this a little bit, it's really nice to link experience with education, if you can. At least in my career, it's always been kind of a must. One of the things I know, when I was a CIO, I had a lot of volunteers that would come in, and we would give them network access. We'd teach them how to, initially do some of the lower end functions of tier two support, if you're familiar with that terminology, but basically desktop support. And we would get them started, let them, go deploy some computer systems and maybe teach them how to do some networking items, teach them how to push out patches. And, as a volunteer, and over time through the volunteering, that some of these people gained a lot of skills and were able to get federal jobs because they were on location, they had network access, and they really could link their education and experience together.
Absolutely. I do have one more question for you. I've noticed two different types of, not just students, but just people in the industry out there. And they are like the type of either project management or technical writing or people that are more oriented into like admin type of roles, like paperwork and things like that. And then people that are more into the technical side prefer to do their jobs on the side and just tell me the task and I'll just do it and I don't want to deal with the politics of it, right? So what are the entry roles that you will say perhaps, and just to give an idea, I've noticed, for example, like a Scrum Master and technical writing are good entry roles for the more like business side of IT. Mm-hmm. What would you say are the best entry type of level jobs?
Oh, I think, well, there is a whole, I guess I never came in through, well, I think you can do project management at the lower end and on smaller projects. I think you can do business analytics, and that's a great pathway. Although it's somewhat non-technical, but it's really part of the bigger information management, information technology career field. Tier two support is a great entry level work. Although, it's not as difficult as it maybe was in the past, but you know, I started out doing tier two desktop support. Then I worked up to networking, you know, doing large scale infrastructure projects. But I do think, you know, you can almost start in desktop support, and that gives you a good framework for both customer service and then the hardware and then the architecture. You know, you really do have to learn the architecture from the desktop to see where's everything hosted. It gives you a good framework.
Can I chime in on that one a bit? I fully agree with you. I got my start doing service desk for a managed services provider. And it gave me exposure to so many different things. And that was the excitement about it, because everything was new. I literally had zero experience. But the person that hired me was a guy in the Air Force that was willing to take me under his wing and, you know, give me that exposure. And, from there, within a period of 6 years, I went from doing that to being a DBA. And it just goes to show you that help desk it gives you that foundational knowledge for everything else. It also, for a lot of people such as myself, it's your introduction to the trifecta, to A+, Network Plus, Security Plus, all of those different things.
Oh, totally agree. I think it really allows you to have for visibility of all of the support systems that support that desktop. Definitely. I think another role, and they have it in the private sector, but you know, we have ISSOs, but information security officers, they're part of the security, arena, not... They don't have to be CISSPs, but they certainly dabble in a lot of NIST documents and FISMA documents that go into getting an ATO, if you guys are familiar with that. If I'm talking Greek, stop me, but every government system has to have an authority to operate, which is permission to operate on the network. So technically, before we post something, we have to do all of the background paperwork, contingency planning, disaster recovery planning documents, privacy documents. There's 13 of them, but that is also another good place to start if you're not quite as technical, and kind of to Nelly's point is if you're more on the administrative side. I think some of the hosting and server room support, a lot of those jobs are being, you know, I guess essentially outsourced to the cloud. That used to be at least in the Air Force, you know, we used to host our own applications. We had our own server rooms, but, you know, that is really not the case, probably even for the Air Force anymore. You know, most of everything is hosted in the cloud. So I think, you know, if you want to, you know, learn about the cloud, you know, there is a lot of cloud jobs out there. And it's certainly the wild, wild west. But they have certifications for AWS. I started taking the classes, and it's a lot of work. But they definitely have videos, and you can actually go through the Amazon videos to learn it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Steve. I don't know if anyone has any additional questions. I think we're at the top of the hour. But I just want to thank you, and I don't know if Ariane is still online, but yes. I think this has been very insightful, and I'll let Ariane give the closing remarks.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Thank you, professors, for speaking, Professor Bouchard, and Professor Gorlecki.
Just call me Steve. It's good.
Steve. I apologize about that. This has been an informational journey throughout this evening. And absolutely. I believe that there was a couple of questions on the chat that we had. for you.
Okay, let me see. So is it... So is it the help desk question?
I think we did address them as we were.
Yeah, I think going. We did.
Yes. But thank you so much. I think this was very helpful, and that's probably one of the biggest things that we struggle with, trying to figure out, hey, what's going to happen after graduation, right? Is it are we going to make it? Are we not going to make it? How is it going to look like? So I think this was very insightful.
Actually, if you have some time, I believe it was from Xavier. Are you familiar with DBV or DB Vets? We use our Oracle. If Xavier is still on the line, if you wanted to ask that question, find out.
Yeah, it wasn't a super important question. When you mentioned Oracle, as a DBA, we don't have direct access to Oracle because of the license costs. I think it was somewhere around $300,000 a person. I'm not sure how they do it now. So, but we access it through something called DBViz. You don't get to see all of the schemas and the full detail you would see directly in Oracle, but was just asking if you were familiar with that at all.
I am not familiar with that. I worked on a project, and I was a implementation manager for a ERP, which is enterprise-wide resource planning tool for the DoD, and it's called Demerzai. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. And it really had a different, like, 100 different sources that would populate it, and then they did have access to all these databases all at once. But we actually had a contract with Oracle, so we didn't have to go through any middleware to write code and modify it.
I appreciate it, and we've actually have maintained a wonderful evening, and thank you again, our guest speakers, for joining us this evening. And if there's not any additional questions, I'd like to go ahead and wish everyone a good evening.
Well, thank you, everyone. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good night.